Broadcasting to New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago, Sydney, London, and around the world, this is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Coming up on this Thursday edition of Trumpet Radio Live, fleeing Boko Haram. A lot of people trying to get away from that terrorist organization. Interesting write-up about what they're going through from the New York Times. We'll talk about that. Also, a new Churchill movie is coming out. Does it get the history right? We'll have a review of that movie. And science is helping a paralyzed man to move. Gives hope to some people. Pretty interesting. That and more, this edition of Trumpet Radio Live.
This is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live on 101.3 KPCG. We are online at kpcg.fm. We have a live link at thetrumpet.com as well. And you can follow us on Twitter if you'd like to, at kpcgfm. And if you'd like to email us, that'd be great. Comments at kpcg.fm. We appreciate getting those too. I'm Dwight Falk, Grant Turgeon, Abraham Blondeau here today. Abraham was excited to show us, you were excited to show us your tie.
Yeah.
You haven't worn this in a decade. And it's a Detroit Red Wings logo tie.
Yeah. Yeah, it's I had it for a long time, and I wore it once, and I was derided for it. That it was not protocol or proper societal manners to wear a hockey tie with a suit in certain circumstances.
Was it because you're in up near Calgary where the Flames play?
No, it's actually in the States. So in Calgary, I almost died on a bus once.
Good idea.
Wearing a Red Wings hat. Hyperbole, of course, but anyway, I saw this. I'm like, oh yeah, I have this, so I wore it. And of course, it's the year they don't make the playoffs, as well.
Wow, there's a lot of history to that tie there.
Yeah,
that would be an interesting book for somebody to write, like the history of ties.
That's true.
A person's tie, and then like some history involving it. Coffee table book. That's a good idea for somebody.
Yeah, how many stains they wiped their. From wiping their face with it or cleaning
that,
their
glasses. That is
with
a thing you think about as a gentleman if you wear a tie. If you spill something on your shirt, but it lands where your tie will cover it, you feel like, it could have been worse. I can cover that up. That's why we wear ties, isn't it? To cover the stains on our shirts?
Well, actually, before, ties used to be really cheap. So it was supposed to protect your shirt.
Mm-hmm.
But now it's the opposite where shirts are cheaper. And you don't want to get your tie dirty because they're so expensive sometimes.
Sometimes.
So it kind of flip-flopped.
I'm all for a really nice tie, I guess, but sometimes the prices, you think, well, what's the difference? I mean,
yeah.
It's a tie. Tie's a tie. Anyway, we could go on and on about the ties. Lots to talk about in today's program. Lots of interesting stories to get into. The Trumpet Daily Radio Show with your host, Stephen Fleury. Hopefully you caught that earlier today. If not, there's always a archive edition you can get at thetrumpet.com and at kpcg.fm. And he talked a lot today about Brexit, and because yesterday, I guess, was the official delivery of the mail, the divorce papers, as it were. And so that mucky and muddy and difficult process is underway. And so he had a lot of details about that this morning.
Yeah, it'll be really interesting to see, because now we finally will get a sense of how this is going to work out. Before, it's all speculation. Now it's where the rubber meets the road. How will Europe want Britain to leave Europe? Will there be some kind of free trade agreement? What kind of, will there be animosity? Will it be a messy divorce or a clean break? So it's going to be interesting. I think the most interesting part is how is this going to affect European security? Because with Britain leaving, this is going to create a big vacuum for Germany and other countries to leave NATO or to just really increase their security forces.
He also mentions, Stephen Fleury mentions on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show some information from articles that were written 10 years ago that are on thetrumpet.com talking about the fact that Britain was going to leave. And so that should, I think, pique people's curiosity. I mean, how would they know that 10 years ago? How would that be written about? And so a lot of great articles to go back and check out there at thetrumpet.com as well. And it'd be interesting to see how it goes. Obviously, I think despite what it said publicly, I think Europe and Germany especially are glad to get rid of Britain. But also I was thinking, you know, it looks like it's going to be a pretty messy deal, and that would probably be in the EU's favor because it would be a warning to all the other nations that you really want to go through this, you know, and it's easier sometimes just to capitulate and go along rather than have all these protracted things have to occur in order to leave.
Well, yeah, it's probably like it's set up for whichever nations pull out of that to fail. And it just also seems like all these nations want to get into the EU before they're in it. And then once they're in it, they realize that they pretty much lose national sovereignty, mostly to Germany, and then they want out. So there's a lot of smoke screens and a lot of deception involved in that.
Non-related, but sort of related. I don't know if you guys saw this story the other day. There's a gold coin in Germany. I think it's the world's biggest gold coin. It's worth like $2 million or something. It's really large. And somebody stole it out of like a museum or wherever it was. It's a huge golden coin. And I thought, well, how do you get out of there with that thing? I was thinking of the gold flakes guy. Remember the guy in Manhattan that stole the bucket of gold flakes? Where is he? Because somebody's going after the gold.
Yeah, that's at least unless he had really deep pockets. I don't think he could fit that huge coin there.
I mean, how would you even get that thing out of there? I don't even think a man could lift it, I guess. I'm not sure how much it weighed, but I think it was quite heavy. You'd need several people, I would think. Well, anyway. And I saw the picture of it, and I thought, that is a huge gold coin.
Yeah.
Where would you keep it?
Well, I saw another report that's kind of related. In Yellowstone, someone stole some fossils from Yellowstone Park, too. Because they're really valuable on the black market if you can sell them. So, and they don't know who it was, and they're asking people for help because thousands of people roam around the park. There's no security cameras, so how do you track them down? It's just a tough deal.
Yeah, well, that's terrible. Well, anyway, interesting. Some people really go after some of those things. Also check out thetrumpet.com today for some headlines and some stories. The feature story today is talking about the mass shootings on the rise. Something has gone seriously wrong with American society. Related to that, the real cause of school shootings and also viewpoint, why kids kill. Those are some related articles. Over the weekend, there were mass shootings again. A couple of headlines. There was a nightclub in Ohio, I want to say, and then a few other places, officers being shot and so forth. So we see this more and more, and it doesn't seem to be getting any better, that's for sure.
Yeah, and it's almost like we're grasping at all the wrong solutions for it, too, and not thinking of maybe something beyond the physical that could have been causing something like that.
So those are some of the headlines there at thetrumpet.com. You can check those out, and those will be some really good reads. And, of course, if you haven't been to thetrumpet.com in a while, it's sort of updated and new in a way. Same good content, just a little bit of a different package there, and some headlines and other things that keep you up to date with what's going on. A few other stories today. This is from Fox News. Alaskan city is buried under record snowfall. It must be global warming. They're having all kinds of snow up there. Not that it's unusual. It's just that they got quite a bit for the date. They say it was a late March surprise for residents of Alaska's largest city, the kind that snarls traffic and keeps kids home for the day. If you live in Alaska, if you live in Anchorage and schools cancel for the day, you know something must have happened. It's not just a dusting. They got 8.8 inches, and that fell between 10 p.m. and 1:30 p.m. between Tuesday and Wednesday. So it fell pretty quickly, and that's the record for March 29th. So they got quite a bit of snow. Video captured a guy driving a bike through it, though. It is Alaska, after all. They're not going to be held down by 8.8 inches of snow.
Just a typical Wednesday for that guy.
The bike did have larger than normal tires, apparently snow tires of some kind.
Huge monster truck tires on the bike as he's pedaling.
You've seen those bikes. They've got the fat tires, they call them.
Yeah.
And I think he was riding one of those guys.
Yeah, I'm surprised he didn't have two reindeer in front of him dragging him through the snow. That's the way to do it.
You know, that actually, not that exact thing, but something similar happened. I don't know. I think it might have been up in Alaska or somewhere up there. Somebody went off the road in their truck, and a dog sled team pulled him out. They hooked up the dogs and pulled the truck out of the thing. But yeah, sometimes you got to go back to the older ways of doing things, and that works better.
Yeah, it's impressive.
Yeah, it's like the technology that we've made actually is less capable at times. It's almost like dogs can do a better job of pulling out than the truck could.
Yeah, they got out of there, so they got a story to tell now anyway. ESPN, very popular cable network over the years. And, of course, the way that people are consuming information is changing. Even ESPN's losing some money. So they're changing some of their formats. You probably noticed they don't do as many highlight shows. It's more talk shows. And they're pushing the personalities of the people more than, say, the highlights. So it's, you know, it's a talk show, basically, about the events. Do you ever wonder how ESPN decides what to talk about? How do they know what exactly is the top story of the day? Any thoughts on that?
I would say an algorithm or something like that on Google. See what like the most searched stories or something like that.
Pretty close. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
So write it from Bloomberg, talking about a whole bunch of things in relation to ESPN and television in general. But this is just an interesting note. They talk about how they determine what they're going to talk about that day. It says, at a standing desk in a corner office, this gentleman by the name of King is his last name. He works there at ESPN and makes a lot of decisions, I guess. It says he's staring at a screen that displays what looks like a stock chart, if you've ever seen one of those, the ups and the downs. It's ESPN's producer panel, custom software for tracking what viewers are talking about on social media. So they're going to track what the hot stories are. And they look at this chart and they say, okay, well, people are talking about Russell Westbrook today, or people are talking about LaVar Ball today. And so then they go and they formulate their whole shows around that. So it's kind of interesting because the job of being like the producer of the show in some ways has kind of changed, because really the people are producing it in terms of, or at least being the program director, like this is what you're going to talk about today. And then they go and find all their stuff and formulate their opinions. But it's all based upon looking at social media.
Wouldn't that basically exclusively target a far younger demographic, though? If you're talking about just people putting things on Twitter, probably the older viewers will not be represented there.
That's true. But that's what they're going after, because the younger generation is cutting the cord, so to speak, with cable packages and television. They want what they want when they want it. You know, I want to go to Netflix and watch whatever I want. I don't have Netflix, but I'm saying for those who do, I always have to throw that out there. Not that it's wrong. I just don't have it. Or anything. You know, if you want content, pretty much you can go get it at any time for the most part. And so knowing that that people can go find all the highlights, they don't need to wait for SportsCenter anymore, because you can watch the highlights 2 minutes after it happens in most cases. They're changing the way they present information. Instead, they're going to have discussion. They're going to talk about it, but it's all based upon what the younger people are tweeting about and posting on Facebook and so forth. So it's a really interesting change in the way that they are putting their shows together.
That probably is a good change to get into some of the discussion a little bit more, just because that's something that you're not going to find quite as often as you would highlights or just a basic article recap that doesn't get into much of the background. If you have people discussing hypotheticals and, you know, some crazy possibilities, that does pique the interest a lot more.
It does. And I think that, I mean, I've watched some of those shows. I usually don't watch their entirety. I watch their, they break them down to a story, and I'll watch the story maybe if I'm interested. And, you know, they have to be a little bit flamboyant in their opinions. I always wonder if they even really feel as strongly as they claim they do, but because they have to build up a little controversy, you know. He's the worst player ever. <You know? laughs> He's the greatest we've ever seen. And then they have to argue about it. And people like it. It's interesting.
Yeah, when I used to watch sports a lot more, this is in Canada, mind you, so I have a much more sparse coverage of things in the America.
Curling tonight?
Yes.
Yeah. TSN is better than ESPN in a lot of ways, though. They're a lot funnier.
Yeah, I think TSN has some great commentators, and it's like hockey, curling, hockey even in the off season, and golf is big up there and that kind of thing. But I used to watch Pardon the Interruption.
Yeah.
Mike Wilbon, and I forget the other guy's name.
Tony Kornheiser.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. And I just watch him in the background while I'm doing other stuff, and it's just nice to hear people's opinions on experts. I'm not an expert in anything, so it's good to hear people who've been in the game a long time, and they just have a lot of insight that you can't get from like a sports recap.
Yeah, and one thing that those shows are doing, which I think is a really good idea, is they're bringing on former players, people that kind of they know the individuals they're talking about, or they were on the team, And that's always really interesting to hear what their take is.
Yeah.
Because they played, they were in the game. So I really like that. But you know what they're looking at the success of like talk radio, because people get attached to the personalities as well as the content. It's not just the content, it's that you want to hear what Skip Bayless has to say or whoever. And so they're kind of doing that same sort of thing. And then now Fox is doing it with their Fox Sports One, I think it is. It's all talk show. Just talking about sports.
Yeah, isn't that like the key pillar of public speaking? What matters most is who is saying it. I think that's actually what impacts people the most, not even so much what is said. So it seems like a lot of these big channels are figuring that out and catering toward that a little bit more.
Yeah, absolutely. Because even if a former player isn't the most articulate, he was there, and so I am interested in what they have to say about it and what their take is. And so in that case, they may not be the expert necessarily, but just the fact that they played with the athlete or the coach or the team that they're discussing that day, it gives you interesting insights. Very interesting.
Yeah, I think for me a great example, just because I grew up with him, was Don Cherry, just watching him on TV. He's not the greatest presenter. Kind of awkward on TV set. He derides his co-host Ron McLean all the time. Like, he's, in terms of like professionalism, he's not someone you think would be so successful. But people love him. The whole country pretty much refuses for him to go away because he is controversial and he doesn't back down. He's called French players wusses and different things like that that people got really mad about. And he's like, well, that's why I think. Too bad. So people like that. He's a controversial figure. He's very strong in his opinions. He was a coach for a long time. He's involved in minor league hockey. So he has a lot of insight. And he doesn't have a lot of broadcast talent, but just his personality is what draws people to him. I think he's a great example on how you can be successful if you have the right package, I guess.
Yeah, ESPN's pushed Scott Van Pelt a bit. He was on the radio network, and they gave him a show, and it's actually gained viewers, where a lot of the other shows have lost viewers. And he's doing that same thing, where he's going to give you his opinion, whether you like it or not. Now, guys get in trouble with that, too, sometimes. But that's what people are looking for. So it's just interesting. This right up here from Bloomberg about ESPN and just cable and television in general. They say, although King there at ESPN concedes that sometimes this approach to social listening, as they call it, can lead to stories that seem overcooked, you know, like, oh, we got to talk about this again. he says, he points out that if ESPN ignores what's happening on social media, it will simply lose viewers to Twitter and Facebook. He says, to me, it's about respecting the audience because they're more sophisticated and more ready to start digging into their own storylines than we give them credit for. Probably true across the board, even with news.
When you just look at SportsCenter's new set and how incredible it is, that didn't really help them. Just all their production value didn't really help them build up a viewership, and that's why they're turning to these other possible solutions. It doesn't matter how good it looks if you're not putting out things that people are actually interested in hearing.
Yeah, there's it's brought up in that Bloomberg article too, that how they spent so much money on that place in Bristol, Connecticut, I think it is, and it looks like a relic already. It was this huge thing, and they said it was future proof. Like, no matter what happens, we were ready to go, and that's not really that relevant as much as they thought it would be, and they've laid off staff and all that. So you if you even look on YouTube, there are people out there that are just hooking up their little cameras on their computers and doing a screenshot of themselves talking about a game. Just watching a game and talking about it, and giving some highlights, and they got millions of people watching them. And it's the worst thing production-wise you've ever seen, but because there's some interest in it, there they go. Mm-hmm. They can compete with the big boys now.
Yeah, it's never thought I'd see that where you have thousands of people just on their couch talking about sports and people are interested in what they're saying. It's like, what was I doing when I was sitting on my couch at home?
You know, the thing I don't get, and I've never watched these, I'm not into it at all, but I know a lot of people like it, is when people play video games and they talk about it.
I knew you were gonna say that.
Yeah.
I saw it one time accidentally because it was like a related video and it confused me. I'm like, what is it? But people really like that. It's just somebody playing a video game, and they want to listen to him talk about it and play it. It blows my mind.
Yeah, it's actually a huge movement. They even have, on Twitter, they have like little live news feeds and that kind of thing. They had like a live one from the Halo tournament that was going on. You have thousands of people in the stadium watching people sitting on it like a screen and playing. And they have like the big screen where you can watch each player. Well, that's a huge thing nowadays, and millions and billions of dollars go into like gaming industry and all that stuff. And it's just people, their whole job is playing video games. They can sit at home, play video games, upload them to YouTube, and they get money from it.
It's unreal.
And it's just, they might be great at playing a video game, but that's not something you should make a living from.
I don't think that's a sustainable career.
Yeah.
I don't think it's got legs when it comes to the, things get a little more serious. It's amazing. So anyway, a lot of the things are changing with media and so forth, and that relates to this next story here somewhat. Talking about playing games all day or whatever. It's from CNN, talking about how screen time is creating bad posture. That's not a surprise, I don't think. We all sit in front of a computer, probably bend over a little forward, slouch. They say, according to the University of Maryland Medical Center, about 60 to 80% of the adult U.S. population suffers from low back pain, making it the second most common reason people go to the doctor. A big reason for that is because of our heads. Our heads are heavy, by the way, 10 to 12 pounds, like a bowling ball up there. They say a lot of us, when we are looking at our screens, our eyes strain and then our neck strains and it pulls our head down into our spines. It's what they call head forward posture. The farther away your head gets from your center with the downward pressure, the more intense the pressure is and it compresses the spine. So as your head gets away from center of your body and it puts all that pressure there, leads to lower back problems.
There's really a lot of interconnected issues involved here. And I've also seen studies where it says that increased screen time also increases your stress levels, which I think affects the kidneys, which also affects lower back problems. So there's a lot of different things that we're doing now that involve screens that are also affecting health negatively.
Yeah, and it's interesting too, because in this article here on CNN, they say that recent studies have linked posture to mood. So your posture affects that. Mood, memory, behavior, and self-esteem. One study recently published in the Journal of Behavior Therapy and Experimental Psychiatry, which, of course, I get every month, showed that if you can't sleep at night, it really helps you out. Showed that when made to sit upright, people battling mid to moderate depression saw their condition improve just by better posture. So we've all heard it a million times, and rightfully so, you know. You need to stand up straight, sit up straight. But it affects more than just our frames. Our mind frame as well is affected.
Yeah, I did a study about this in college for a speech. And it is amazing all the different studies and reports about body language and just how your posture is related to that. Just how much you tell people by what you look like, just how you stand up, how you walk. The kind of gestures you use. And I think it goes a long way in even defining the kind of person you are. Because if you have good posture and you're very confident and you, especially if you're maybe in a leadership position and you use certain gestures that convey confidence, people are going to follow that a lot easier than someone who's always like bent over and like halfway collapsed on themselves in their chair and not using very confident gestures. Even when I would referee in college, the person over it would go after me in my first game because he said, like, your gestures aren't big enough. You look like you're being like a weakling out there, not being confident in your gestures. To me, I thought they were okay, but you have to use big gestures and be very confident so the players know, like, oh, that he means that, or he's confident he made the right call. So even things like that, I think it goes a long way in just our self-image, if I can use that word, and being confident with who you are and being able to convey confidence to others too.
There's another interesting study that actually was talked about here on KPCG yesterday. Gino Chi is a student at Herbert W. Armstrong College here where we're broadcasting from, and he does a little bit of radio work and has some really interesting stories he brings on. And he had one about how if you want to tell, there's a really good way they've determined, they think, we can really gauge somebody's personality type, and that's by asking them what they think about somebody else. Because if the first thing they think of or they come up with is negative, they're probably a negative person because that's what they see. If they say something positive, they're probably a positive person because that's just what they see. Because you can kind of find either one. It just depends on what you're looking at. I'm not saying that's foolproof or 100%, but that was just a really interesting thing. Like sometimes we expose more about ourselves than we realize with our posture, with what we say, And it is pretty revealing for just a self-study.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. Just usually, well, as the Bible says, oh, the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. So if all we do is complain or rattle off negative things, we probably have a lot of negative thoughts going around in our head, and that's not a great thing. It's always good to have a positive mental attitude. And I think that positive mental attitude also is reflected in our body posture and our body language and that sort of thing.
How many of the listeners just tried to sit up straighter? I'm trying to yeah. As I'm doing this. I'm like, oh, hang on now a second. One quick one here before we get into Grant's, to your story. This, anytime a snake attacks, you got to talk about it. Jakarta, Indonesia, 25-year-old Indonesian man went missing. They found him. He was inside of a snake. Yes, inside of a snake. He was swallowed whole by a python on the island there over in Indonesia, one of the islands. And amazing. Thing came up behind him, a python. So I think it was 23 feet long. Swallowed him whole.
Wow. I'm not going to Jakarta anytime soon.
way to go.
They say it's rare. I mean, obviously. Yeah. But this happened. It came up from behind him because there was a mark on his back, so it struck him or whatever, and swallowed him. So they got him out, but too late, of course. Those pythons, they're the reticulated pythons. They grab onto their prey with dozens of sharp, curved teeth and then squeeze it to death before swallowing it whole. Wowzeronies. They're widespread in Indonesia and other parts of Southeast Asia. It's very rare that they would attack a human, as it says here, but in the wild, they are known to eat monkeys, pigs, and other mammals. Wow. Huh. That's huge. 23 feet. There's a video on it. I mean, not saying you want to watch it, but when they went and found the snake, they could tell because it obviously was expanded.
Yeah. Wow.
So poor guy. What did he do? He worked palm oil fruit. He was picking some of that. I'm not sure how that process works. So they found the thing he was using to do the work and one boot.
Oh.
And then the snake.
That's the stuff that makes up nightmares in the movies from Hollywood. And it's it's tragic, too, that it would happen like that for him.
Yeah.
And the family. But I remember seeing a video of a snake eating a baby elephant or a baby hippo whole too, same type of thing.
Yeah.
And it's amazing that it could expand to take in that mass,
mm-hmm.
but it just went for it.
There's a really cool video I saw online. I'm sure you can find it pretty easily of a cobra, right? Those are the ones that puff their neck out and stuff.
Yes.
Is that a cobra?
Right. Yeah.
It was somewhere over in that area too. I don't remember where. These construction workers are kind of digging around at the foundation of a home in this dirt. And the thing flies out of there at him with all, you know, its neck puffed up. It's pretty amazing. I guess it was living down there and it came out ready. They woke him up, apparently.
Yeah.
They were able to back away, thankfully. But I thought, boy, can you imagine that? You're just kind of fooling around, you know, by the wood pile or something. The cobra comes out like that. Amazing.
Wow.
Yeah, I think those are some of the most aggressive in the world. And I remember watching The Crocodile Hunter back in the heyday there. And he was... Steve Irwin, right?
Right.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. He died. He was. Yeah. He got stung. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. He was. He found this cobra and he had. He put on the sunglasses right away because some cobras spit venom at you.
Oh.
And if it gets in your eye, it can blind you. So he had to put on his glasses until he identified it. Then it was like standing up like 3 feet and like they were moving in circles around each other because he was like trying to figure out what to do. So just amazing creatures.
Yeah. Terrifying. So anytime you see that, you gotta at least make a mention. Because I saw the headline from the New York Post, and I was like, what? So I had to look at it. You're listening to Trumper Radio Live here on 101.3 KPCG. And Grant, you've got an article for us here from the New York Times. Really interesting. Fleeing Boko Haram, thousands cling to a road to nowhere. They've got a really interesting aerial shot of this. It's just a village kind of popped up around this road to nowhere. People are just trying to get away from Boko Haram.
Yes, and this gigantic village has just sprung up along this highway. It was actually originally begun by the Chinese, this road, and yet because Boko Haram kept attacking in the area, the Chinese abandoned the project. The road actually is going like it's supposed to go across the continent, and then it just stops right there. It's in Niger, and it's meant to just continue going eastward, I believe, or westward. So... just a pretty insane situation there. A lot of people obviously have been fleeing from Boko Haram, the terrorist group in Nigeria, coming down to this area. 130,000 people just right along the road. And the reason for that is because soldiers from Niger actually go up and down the road on patrol. So at least in this way, the people can feel somewhat safe.
Where are they getting their it's like a tent city. Where are they getting their supplies from? Water, food, etc.
Well, in a lot of cases, they just they had to run from Boko Haram as it invaded their village, and they took as much as they could with them. There is a river nearby as well, I believe, and a lot of the time they're just going out into the brush and picking things out themselves, kind of refining them a little bit, and then selling them in these markets that have popped up along the road. There's also, I believe, 27 schools along the road set up by UNICEF. Just a lot going on there. There has been some humanitarian aid. Some of the nearby villages have been helping them out a little bit too. But all of these people just have horrifying stories of fleeing, having family members slaughtered, you know, running away from Boko Haram and then being separated from family members, never to see them again. Just a lot of terrible stories going on there.
Yeah, it would be horrifying. And, you know, I think for all of us, we'd like to have some sort of a plan moving forward in our lives. You know, we hope that, you know, we're going to live in this place and do this sort of thing, and we kind of build our lives in that way. And you have people like this and a lot of others, I'm sure, refugees that day to day, it's kind of a guesswork. Like, where are you going to be tomorrow, or where are you going to be in 3 weeks? Or if you were a parent, what am I going to do with my, you know, what future do my children have? A lot of people on this earth facing those daily questions.
Yeah, and some of the refugees interviewed had to flee 4 or 5 separate times. So they would flee, they'd put down roots, however temporary they might have been, and then all of a sudden Boko Haram came to where they had fled to, and they had to flee again. Apparently, though, so far Boko Haram has kept its distance from this highway to nowhere, and that has allowed a lot of people to find out about it and come to that area.
Yeah, that was a question that I had, was what happens if they come to this road? It hasn't happened yet, thankfully, but obviously they would be pretty vulnerable there, especially if the present soldiers that are there now weren't there protecting
exactly
them.
Yeah, it's almost like they're just waiting for Boko Haram to finally come to that area. They are being driven out of Nigeria a little bit, the terrorist group that is, but they haven't quite come to this road in Niger, even though in Niger, they have a pretty good stronghold there still.
Really interesting. And, yeah, you know, Boko Haram, I guess they kind of got on my radar, I guess, when they took those girls. That was the big
from
story.
From that school, a couple hundred of them or something.
Right, and that kind of got into the national media here in the U.S. And but is there anything being done in terms of trying to overthrow them, or are they just continuing on their rampages?
Well, it looks like they're being fought by some of these groups. I think soldiers from these countries in, I believe it's Northeast Africa, are kind of banding together to try and fight back. And they do have a few solid military forces that, at least whenever they're combined, can fight Boko Haram. But they're not exactly eradicating them. They're just holding them to where they are. That's kind of what the issue is here.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see the number of just refugees worldwide in general, when you add up all the groups basically coming from the Middle East and African regions, seems like at this point anyway. And you know, what do you do with all these people? I mean, do they mention in the article at all, what is there a plan to help these people, or they're just existing there and let's see what the future brings?
It doesn't seem like they have too much hope in this situation. Like I said, they did set up some schools along the road, and there are some villages where people who have fled from the same areas are now taking some of the same spots along the highway. So it's like these groups that have been driven out are still sticking together along the road. They're getting a little bit of humanitarian aid, a little bit of support from local villages nearby. Doesn't go too much further than that.
It is frustrating, I imagine, for many, many people that, you know, they would like to help these people or do something, but you know, the individual is pretty much powerless against these terror groups and these situations. And even as far as going in and fighting against some of them, you know, you knock one out and then the next one pops up. I mean, even with ISIS, right? I mean, they're kind of on the run. At least that's the thought. But then there's all these other groups that are still popping up all over the place and leaving just destroyed villages, towns, and hundreds of thousands, or millions, I suppose, of refugees all over the place.
Yeah, and what you'll see all over thetrumpet.com, especially recently, is that a solution to that is it has to be a change in the mind. As long as that type of ideology of murdering to achieve a goal exists, it doesn't matter if you take out one group. You haven't stopped the mindset that is inspiring things like that. That's just going to keep on happening. And you can just imagine people in those situations just really hoping that the world changes in a big way.
Yeah, they certainly need it. Everybody does. There's a lot of good write-ups at thetrumpet.com about Boko Haram, including these titles: Boko Haram Massacres Thousands, Boko Haram Exporting Terrorism Beyond Nigeria, and Boko Haram Expands the Islamic State Caliphate to Nigeria. Those are from a few months back, and they give you some of the history and details about Boko Haram there. So, again, I think a lot of people know them kind of on the surface from taking those girls from that school, but they're still very active and they're still leaving a lot of terror in their wake. And so this is a write-up from the New York Times: fleeing Boko Haram, thousands cling to a road to nowhere. Pretty sad situation there, but a very interesting article.
Yeah, definitely it is.
Thanks for bringing that to us, Grant.
Thank you.
You're listening to Trumpet Radio Live here on 101.3 KPCG, and we're online too at kpcg.fm. We have a live link at thetrumpet.com. If you'd like to follow us on Twitter, we'd love to have you do that at kpcgfm. And you can email us comments at kpcg.fm. We appreciate getting those as well. This is Trumpet Radio Live. I'm Dwight Falk, Grant Turgeon, and Abraham Blondeau here today. And Abraham, this is a really interesting article you've got from a website I've never heard of, thescientist.com. It's pretty epic sounding. But this is a neat story. Paralyzed man moves arm with neuroprosthetic. They say two chips implanted in a quadriplegic patient's motor cortex and 36 electrodes in his right arm allow the man to control the movement of his right arm and hand. So they do a lot of, you know, they work towards a lot of developments in these areas. And sometimes things like this, it looks pretty hopeful, like they could really help some people.
Yeah, I think the idea of someone getting a robotic arm or something from sci-fi to replace a lost limb or to recover mobility after becoming basically paralyzed. And so this is a pretty big breakthrough. He's not the first one, but it is a really interesting development. And basically what they have to do in these situations is when someone's a quadriplegic or paralyzed, usually it's because of their spinal cord. The brain sends signals down the nerve center in the spinal cord. And if their neck is broken or something like that, the spinal cord is cut off from the brain. And so without the spinal cord, the other limbs don't have any guidance. They don't have any, can't gain any guidance from the brain on what to do. And that's usually why someone's paralyzed.
Yeah, it's amazing. We all, those of us that are blessed with movement, we move and don't really think about it. You know, we don't have to sit there and think, hand move, you know. It just happens. But there are these processes going on. And if they're interrupted, obviously, then you can't anymore. Which, when you do move, it seems so strange that that could happen. But obviously, it does to quite a few people.
Yeah, I mean, I think we all know someone who's been in an accident and they've lost mobility. In a stroke, that's kind of the same thing that happens, where a catastrophic event happens in the brain and it blocks certain parts of the brain. So those signals can't get to a certain side or a certain motor function or something like that. So scientists, what they do with neuroprosthetics is they find a way around that blockage. So for the Bill Kochavar, he's 56. He's the quadriplegic. It's his spinal cord is blocking. There's a blockage there. So what they do is these two chips are in his motor cortex, and there's a cord that comes out of his head, and it goes into this metal harness, this metal arm, basically. And then that metal arm is attached to his arm, where there are 36 electrodes or 36 receivers. And so basically what it does is it circumvents that blockage in the spinal cord, and his thoughts, those little neural impulses, can go through that cord to the 36 electrodes and his hand can interpret that into movement. And so what it allows that, with the harness helps him lift it and all that, lift his hand, it actually allows him just by thinking to move his hand. In fact, they said it's the first time he's been able to eat and drink himself in 10 years by using this type of device. And he's even learned how to scratch his nose, and he has to learn how to use it.
Yeah.
Sometimes he says he has to think really, really hard, but it's getting easier and easier to use it. And just amazing that, I mean, it's maybe something that not a lot of people would like to do themselves in the similar situation, but it is amazing that scientists could create some kind of computer program that can read the human mind, or like the impulses, translate it to a computer, and then translate it back to the human hand to translate it into motion.
Yeah. That's really amazing. You can imagine working on a project like that and trying to explain it to somebody.
Right.
You know, like, hey, what are you working on? Well, you know, you could give them the basics, but you couldn't tell them, like, the specifically how you're doing it, because it would be just confusing to most of us. That's an amazing use of technology, though. It's good to see, because there are a lot of bad uses of technology as well, but there's a lot of good ones, and it is nice to see them doing something like that. Seems like quite a contraption.
Yes.
But I'm sure as they develop it and work with it, they'll, like everything, things get smaller and a little more refined, and so maybe it'll be something people could use in the future.
Yeah, there's actually another, in 2012, Ian Burkhart, he was paralyzed in a diving accident, and he was the first one to have this kind of neuroprosthetic. Basically, he has a sleeve on his arm and hand with electrodes in his arm, and that sleeve allows him to move his arm. So it's not a harness like this other man has, but it's like a sleeve he has to wear over his arm. So it's a little impractical now. It's just kind of bulky, and you can't really, like, you can't travel with it and that kind of thing. But I mean, it is for certain people, short of divine healing or something like that, it's the only way people can regain their motion that science has discovered in that way. And so it is amazing that, and it's good to see, like you said, that there's still some projects out there that can make a difference for people, and that aren't being used in a negative way.
Yeah. Yeah, really interesting. I think probably one of the reasons that this is, you know, kind of going, at least it seems like, in a pretty good direction, is they're just taking something the body would do normally and trying to figure out how to help it do it.
Right.
You know, sometimes things get a little, you know, they start combining things like embryos and stuff, and that gets a little out there. But with this, I mean, that's what the body should do, and they're just building a bridge basically to let it send the signals again. And that's pretty great, I think.
Yeah, it's like a really sophisticated wheelchair or like crutches, where it's not replacing, you're not, like with stem cells, you're not trying to regenerate something unnaturally. You're using a device to help you do things that you just can't do anymore. And so it uses a lot of integration with your brain. But it is just a really sophisticated way of helping someone just, get, probably for him, he was so excited he could actually do something himself.
Yeah.
Otherwise, he just sits there and he can't do anything himself. So for us, I think we just can't understand that feeling. But for him, it must have been so liberating to be able to feed and drink himself after 10 years.
It's good to look at stories like that, too, because it's easy to get, not be thankful, I guess is what I'm trying to say, about just the basic things that we do that we can take for granted. And then you read about somebody like that and puts it all in perspective a little more. Just those basic movements that some people just cannot do. It's a blessing to be able to do those.
Yeah, I think, when we interact with our grandparents or older people, and I know some older people I've helped out, they always express to me, like, it takes them an hour to make their bed sometimes, that sort of thing. And for us, I mean, you just make it in 5 seconds. You just throw it over and you don't really think about it. But just the basics of living, the things we do that we can kind of do on the back burner really quickly so we can get on with, like, work or doing other things we want to spend our time on. For them, that is their life. Just being able to do the very basics of living is an achievement every day. And I think we've all had experiences with that, and it always should make us, I think, grateful that we have health and that we do have the ability not only to do things ourselves, but to to help other people who have lost some of that mobility.
Really good write-up there. Thescientist.com. Paralyzed man moves arm with neuroprosthetic. Pretty interesting use of technology there. You've got one other story for us. I have a feeling you're going to really like this one because you like history quite a bit, and certainly Winston Churchill. And this is from Heat Street, which has interesting write-ups from time to time. And the title is, new movie about Winston Churchill is, quote, a perverse fantasy which deserves to be a flop. They didn't pull any punches in their title. And so what is this movie about?
Yeah, this is written by Andrew Roberts, so he's a pretty well-known historian. At the moment, he's working on writing a biography about Churchill. And so he wrote a movie review, and this movie is called Churchill. And it's about the last few days in June before D-Day, before Operation Overlord. And it's supposed to depict Winston Churchill's life during that week in a run-up to June 6, 1944. And this is what Andrew Roberts says. It's a very scathing review, and I think it deserves to be so. And as this is what he says about the movie. The only problem with the movie, written by the historian Alex von Tuzelman, is that it gets absolutely everything wrong. Never in the course of movie making have so many specious errors been made in so long a film by so few writers.
kind of misquoting another famous quote there, or using it, I guess.
Yeah.
If you're a historian like this man, and you write, you know, you're writing about these people, it would be infuriating to see this twisted version of history. What do they get wrong in it? What are they trying to portray in this movie about Churchill?
Yeah, so it's actually pretty shocking, just, I guess, the basic plot that it was actually produced in the first place. Basically, the major premise of the movie is that it's about Churchill opposing Operation Overlord through that week, basically doing everything in his power to stop it from even happening. And that is thoroughly unhistorical. Churchill did oppose a second front in Europe through the earlier war years, 1942 to 1943. But when in 1944, he was all for it. And there's no historical evidence at all to suggest that he was basically trying to sabotage Operation Overlord. Like, that whole, the whole premise of the movie is fiction. And then from there, it just gets worse and worse. And what Andrew Roberts does, he quotes different diaries from different people about what Churchill was saying and doing at that time, and it's the complete opposite of what goes on in the movie. And just the way they portray him is also, I think, amounts to libel. It's, I think, character assassination, the way they portray him. They portray him as always drinking alcohol all the time, basically, and he makes some comments that he relies on alcohol to get through the day, that sort of thing, which wasn't true. He even, in the movie, he's depicted as yelling and arguing with Dwight Eisenhower, Bernard Montgomery, Alan Brooke. They pass insults, curses, swearing at each other, which never happened. If they have Dwight Eisenhower yelling at Winston Churchill, which if that happened, Dwight Eisenhower probably would have been relieved of duty, because you can't yell at the leader of another country, of your ally. And this, a lot of language that wouldn't have been used back then, like swears and a lot of discourteous things between generals, made up dialogue that just basically makes everyone look less than what they actually were in real life.
That seems to be kind of the aim for some of these films over the years, where they'll take somebody that is a very heroic figure historically, and they try to debase them and make them look just very shady and very despicable in their behavior. And, you know, from, like, say, Eisenhower, I mean, what I've read about him, that's not his character at all. He wasn't one to sit there and yell at his superiors, and that wasn't him at all as far as, you know, just his character in general. But they always, for some reason, want to just kind of drag the character of those people through the mud. And I don't know why. It seems like it's almost as if to say, well, they're not as good as you think they are. And to just make this really negative portrayal of some really historically pretty great men that did some amazing things, and they're just trying to to make it look despicable. And that's I think it's a terrible thing.
Yeah, I think it's a rash of movies that try to debase the past to our standards. So I think by rewriting history, it makes us look better than we actually are. I think that's the point of it all. And also shames people who, like Winston Churchill, a lot of people today don't like him because they view him as an imperialist, a racist, which he wasn't certainly imperialist, but he definitely wasn't a racist. And so just another assault on his character by trying to, because why was Churchill great? And people don't want to admit it's because he was an imperialist, because he loved the British Empire. And it's those virtues of empire that made him great. And if without admitting that, if you do admit that, you're admitting that maybe the British Empire was a good thing and not a bad thing. And a lot of people don't like that. In this movie, though, I think the worst part of it all, besides they show Churchill as a petulant, ill-tempered, sarcastic, unpleasant, decrepit, oafish, drunken man in this movie. And he wasn't that at all. He certainly had his bad days. But I think the worst of all is that the way that it portrays him and his wife. There's certain scenes in the movie where Churchill's yelling at her and he throws plates off the table. And in one scene, Clementine slaps him across the face and packs up her bags like she's going to leave him. And that never happened at all. And so if you're a historical figure, you always have detractors. But to attack someone's marriage in that kind of way and basically slander it in an audience before a huge nationwide audience, I think that's something that should never have happened.
Well, I think it's a really good point you made that, you know, they're trying to apparently fit it into our lack of morals today. And when you look at the marriage numbers and the divorce numbers and in the West, they're not good. They're high, or there's all kinds of problems there. And so it's probably in that same vein of thinking that, well, it would kind of shame us if it was portrayed where it was an outstanding, you know, relationship and where he was really an upstanding individual. And it would make us maybe feel bad about ourselves or reevaluate what we're doing today. But to bring them down to our level, the lowest common denominator, then maybe we feel better about ourselves. I think that's pretty insightful.
Yeah, I think that's a great point you break just about the marriage. And even, too, I think if you study into the morals of that time, most of Churchill's contemporaries, most of them had mistresses, and they were infamous for cheating on their wives, for the wives cheating on their husbands. Even Churchill's mother and father were very promiscuous individuals. That's not a slander against them. That's just fact, unfortunately. And so Churchill was probably, in his generation, the most loyal husband you'll find in Great Britain. He never did anything against his wife in having an affair or even looking at another woman. And it's that pillar of his marriage is what helped him make him a great man as well. And so when you compare him to his contemporaries have our morals. But he's the one who rose above them, became the greatest Briton, not the other people who are cheating on their spouses. So I think if you study more into that history of even marriages at that time, it makes Churchill look even brighter, because he did have an outstanding marriage and he had an outstanding character. And so with this movie, just a terrible, especially for this generation who do rely on movies more for their past understanding. If someone was to watch this and they hadn't read a book about him, they might think like, well, why do we learn about him? He was just a drunk and he was terrible to his wife. And in one scene, they portray him as on his knees praying to God to send rain and a storm on the English Channel to stop D-Day from happening. And that never happened at all. So things like that were... is distinctly, I don't know, Miss Tuzzleman, the writer of it, I'm not sure what nationality she is, but definitely an anti-British, showing that Britain was trying to stop the American spearhead against Nazi Germany and that kind of thing. So what the great irony to put the cherry on top, I guess, is that Miss Tuzzleman herself wrote a book called Real History, The World According to Movies, and she criticizes movies for changing history in them.
Hmm.
And yet that's the exact same thing she just did herself. So it's just a puzzling movie in the first place. And as Andrew Roberts goes through, is that he just dismantles it, and rightfully so. And that's why he says it should be a flop. And if it's not a flop, if it's popular, then we do as a society, we do deserve to fall and to decline because we're allowing our heroes to be villainized.
Yeah, that's a sad, sad thing. Yeah, hopefully it doesn't get too many people watching it.
Yeah.
Because it's a just complete fabrication. You might as well put Darth Vader in the movie with him.
Yeah, exactly.
You're just going to start making stuff up. But I don't know. They take some license sometimes, and maybe it's, you know, they're trying to spice it up in their minds to get more people to watch. I'm not sure. But anyway, that's Reddit from Heat Street. New movie about Winston Churchill is a perverse fantasy which deserves to be a flop. That's their title, so strongly worded, but that's the title they have there. And so kind of interesting, especially when you consider some of the great, great things that Winston Churchill did. That's too bad that they're doing that. Make sure you listen for the Key of David program, also the Trumpet Daily Radio Show coming up here in a bit on KPCG, focusing a lot on Brexit today, and also a new episode of The Sun Also Rises. You can find that here at KPCG or online. You can get the archives, kpcg.fm and the Trumpet. com. That's all the time we have for today on Trumpet Radio Live. Thanks for spending some of your Thursday with us. Have a great rest of your day. For myself, Dwight Falk, Grant Turgeon, Abraham Blondo, thanks for being with us. We'll talk to you again tomorrow.
You're listening to Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG.